April 15th. Welcome, everybody, to the House Rules Committee. Just want to announce, starting off, that we are not going to open a work session on House Bill 3483. We will be rescheduling that at a later date. So if you're here for 3483, now I would like to open a public hearing and work session on HCR 26. Erin, will you please
About this measure? Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. HCR 26 is in memoriam to David Michael Jones, 1945 to 2015. We have no revenue, no fiscal impact.
Okay, Elizabeth Remley.
How do these microphones work? Do I have to bring closer to me? Chair Hoyle, Vice Chair Gilliam, Vice Chair Smith Warner, and members of the committee, it is a pleasure to be here today. I am Elizabeth Remley here on behalf of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. HCR 26 is a bill that honors one of our most beloved and longtime members and a really important member of the physician assistant community. Dave Jones moved to Condon, Oregon in 1980 and was one of the only primary care providers in his entire county of Gilliam County for a really long time, and in fact served as the medical examiner until his death. He was the first PA in the nation, I believe, that had independent prescription writing authority. He was the first PA in Oregon who had remote supervision by a physician. That actually paved the way for the way that PAs are licensed and practice medicine today. Dave Jones passed away sort of suddenly after a really short bout with pancreatic cancer in January, and so we have this memorial drafted. He'll actually, his family will be here on PA Day, which is next week, and we hope to have them on the floor, and we hope you see them there, and I urge your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions or discussion? Okay.
I just have a quick question. Beth, we may have to get this later, but what was his path to Oregon? You said he came to Condon. Where did he do his work and so forth?
Chair Hill, Vice Chair Gilliam, he was born in Seattle. He received a bachelor's degree in 1968 and in another bachelor's degree in 1970, both from the University of Washington. And he served in the U.S. Army Reserves for 6 years, from 65 to 71. And then he moved to Condon from, I believe, Seattle in 1980.
Thank you. So. Madam Chair, I will make a motion if you're open.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I move HCR 26 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has made a motion, has moved that HCR 26 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any objection? Seeing none, this motion passes. We will ask Representative Greg Smith to carry this resolution. Thank you very much. With that, I will open up. And I close the work session, public hearing and work session on HCR 26. With that, open up a public hearing on House Bill 3433, and Greg Wasson, please come on up and identify yourself for the record. Thank you for being here.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3433 repeals statutes requiring review by local election officials of proposed initiative measures for compliance with constitutional single subject rule. You have no revenue impact on the measure. A fiscal impact statement has not yet been provided.
For the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Greg Wasson. I am the incorporator, sole member, and executive secretary of the Committee for Petition Rights. I have degrees in journalism, political science, and law from the University of Oregon, spent 15 years as a member of the press corps just down the hall, and 10 years as an attorney. A gambling problem and a alcohol problem led the bar to suggest that I take a 5-year vacation from the law. And at the end of 5 years, I'd figured out how to go to court without being an attorney, so I said, thanks, but no thanks. I'd like to preface my remarks by saying that I'm convinced that being born an American was the smartest thing I ever did in my life. If I sound cynical at times, please forgive me. I sort of get that way sometimes. This bill has there are two reasons for this bill. One is quite technical. I understand that this graph is up on your computer screens. When the people approved the initiative amendment in 1902, 11 to 2, think about that. We were approving it. No one could predict what the initiative was going to do to state government. We might have ended up moving from the fire pan into the fire. Yet almost every person who voted for it agreed to take the gamble. So things must have been real bad. But when they did that, all they did was break the legislative leg in half. Didn't change the relationship between the legislature and the executive or the courts. For the county clerk to say to me, this initiative is unconstitutional and you can't circulate it, is just like the Secretary of State coming to your office and saying, this bill is unconstitutional, and I've instructed the state printer not to print it. You wouldn't stand for it. And I wouldn't stand for it if I had anything to do about it. But the only thing I can do about it is come to you and ask for your help. The second reason for this bill, I hope that everybody's familiar with the waterfront park here in Salem. There was an effort in the late 80s by the city of Salem to build a convention center and hotel on that park. An ad hoc group that included the late governor, just call me Bob Straub, formed, gathered signatures in 100 days. 100 days. In Salem, you have to gather signatures in 100 days. If I lived in Grants Pass or Corvallis or any other town that went by state law, I'd have 2 years. The equal protection problems with that are just obvious, but that's, a topic for another day. But anyway, we were able to stop that convention center. It didn't cost us any money. I recently filed an initiative with the city recorder to rename that park after William S. Urin, the greatest Oregonian who ever lived. And the city recorder refused to even let me go out and gather signatures on that petition. So I went to the circuit court. The circuit court refused to order the city recorder to follow the law. As soon as I get the final order in that case, I'm going to walk down the street to the Supreme Court and say, tell the circuit court judge to tell the city recorder to follow the Constitution. This bill would repeal a statute that allows either the local administrators or the local judges, local courts, to consider the constitutionality of an initiative until and unless it's approved at the polls. Right now, there are people in Columbia County who want to pass an unconstitutional text to prohibit the county, the oil trains from going through the county. The fact that it's unconstitutional should not matter. Those people want to pass that petition. What better way, if we are to have a truly representative government, what better way are you for you to know what your constituents think than if they vote on something? So with that, I'll close. And Gladly take any questions.
Any questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Wilson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, will we have, do we have other folks set to testify on this from a legal standpoint?
We do.
Okay. Thanks.
Yes. Anyone else? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate
your testimony. And with that, I would like to call up John DiLorenzo.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner with the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I'm here this afternoon on behalf of my very longtime client, Oregonians for Food and Shelter, to oppose House Bill 3433. As many of you know, OFS has been active in both the legislature and in the initiative process on behalf of those who rely on modern farming methods to bring their crops to market. I have represented OFS and its members on a number of occasions for the purpose of testing the constitutionality of local initiatives. Article 4, Section 12D of the Constitution requires all initiative petitions to include the full text of the law which they propose. In addition, the section also requires every proposed law to embrace one subject only and matters properly connected. The Constitution extends these requirements to county, municipal, and district-wide elections. ORS 230.175, 230.375, and 255.145, which are all repealed by this bill, require county, city, or local district officials to first ensure that the initiatives which are proposed by citizen petition first comply with the procedural requirements in the Oregon Constitution. 255.140 creates a procedure whereby a local initiative petition can first be tested by a court to determine whether it meets those constitutional requirements. House Bill 3433 does away with those requirements, and in Section 3 of the bill also repeals the entire pre-election determination procedure in ORS 255.140. In addition, it repeals 250.175 and 250.275, which control how local officials prepare ballot titles for county measures and city measures. If the legislature enacted House Bill 3433, the constitutional requirements would still remain. Litigants would be free to challenge whether local initiatives complied with procedural requirements at any time. We, along with others who both propose and resist initiatives, believe that it is better to have a court make those determinations prior to the time a local district, city, or county expends taxpayer funds necessary to conduct an election, and prior to the time that the proponents and opponents have expended large sums of money to campaign for the measure. Now, I am attaching to my testimony a recent example, which shows how a court goes about examining a proposed local initiative for constitutional compliance. The orders that are attached to my testimony all related to a local food system ordinance, which was filed in September 20, 2013 in Lane County. By September 27th, the county clerk had issued a written determination concerning whether the measure complied with the Constitution. Shortly thereafter, on October 4, the Lane County Council had prepared a ballot title and had filed the same with the Lane County clerk. On October 15, my client filed a case in the circuit court seeking a court determination as to whether the measure truly complied with these constitutional provisions. Shortly thereafter, the chief petitioner intervened. The matter was briefed. It was expeditiously decided by the court. In that case, the court ruled that the proponents failed to comply with the full text rule of the Constitution and violated the single subject rule in numerous particulars. The court therefore ordered that the initiative would not be authorized for circulation. Now, had House Bill 3433 been enacted, these determinations would have likely been made after the proponents had expended great time and effort to gather their signatures, after Lane County had spent significant resources with respect to an election, and after the proponents and the opponents had spent all the money for the campaign. Only after all of that would this particular measure have been declared invalid by the courts? The current process, Madam Chair, saves all concerned, especially local governments, from having to expend resources for nothing. House Bill 3433 makes no practical sense for either proponents or opponents of initiatives. I ask that you take no further action on this bill. And I thank you very much for your courtesies. I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? No, thank you very much. Rebecca Roth. Rebecca Roth wanted to testify.
Madam Chair, my name is Rebecca Roth, and this bill, I think, has some validity because it allows people in their local communities to create initiative petitions and not be stymied by courts. And I've been a signature collection person for many years, and done that because I've had things I've wanted to promote, and I've seen there be trying to get us to not create certain petitions, and then also after petitions have been declared constitutional by one court, then you put it on the ballot and you go through the, like he said, all the expense and effort, and it does get passed, and then the next court decides it's not constitutional. That happened with the marriage bill, which Oregonians, by a large majority, supported one man, one woman marriage, and then it just recently was invalidated by another court. So I think it's good for these ideas to be put before the people and to have people be able to do the petitions. And also, it very much is against the people's rights to have so many bills in the legislature have emergency clauses attached to them so that we're not able to do referendums on them. We, as people of Oregon, we do not appreciate you going around us and not representing the people of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Roth. With that, thank you very much, everyone, for testifying. And we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3433. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3287. Sal Peralta and Dan Meek have signed up to testify.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3287 permits major political parties to establish membership duration requirements for primary candidates by certified party rule filed with Secretary of State. It permits major political parties determined by certified party rule whether persons not affiliated with party can win party nomination by write-in vote, or whether write-in candidates must receive certain percentage of votes to be nominated. There is an emergency clause on the measure. Representative Bueller, who is the sponsor of the bill, did submit a -1 amendment. It is on OLIS for you today. It makes a couple changes to the measure. It extends to 180 days rather than 70th day before the election in which a political party must file with the Secretary of State regarding party duration. And it then establishes to receive the nomination of a party, a write-in candidate must receive a number of votes equal to percentage specified in party rule. So those are the two changes from the underlying bill.
Your choice, who goes first?
Madam Chairman, I'll go first. I'm Dan, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Dan Meek. I'm co-chair of the Independent Party of Oregon. And no surprise, the Independent Party supports this bill. As you know, Independent Party is now Oregon's third major party, its membership having exceeded 5% of all Oregon registered voters. But the final determination on major party status for the 2016 election cycle won't be made by the Secretary of State until sometime in August. The last date to do so is August 16th of this year. This bill would enable the independent party, which we call IPO for short, to offer a much larger number of candidates to its voters in the 2016 primary election. because current statutes really inhibit that and will inhibit that in two different ways. First, current statutes restrict candidates in a major party primary to persons who have been members of the party for 180 days prior to the filing deadline, which is effectively 250 days before the primary election. So the deadline to potentially become a candidate in the IPO primary for 2016 is September 10th, 2015, which may be a mere 25 days after the Secretary of State finally determines that IPO is indeed a major party for that election cycle. Now, while this 8-month advanced party membership requirement may well be no problem for long-established parties, which have stables of potential candidates and folks who are paying attention, it, I believe, will be a substantial barrier to participation by political novices or others interested in earning the nomination of a brand new major party. Many of them will not be experienced politicians and may not be planning to run for office more than 8 months in advance of the primary election. Others will simply be unaware of the 250-day advanced party membership requirement in existing law. They simply have to know about it and change their party registration by September 2015, which is 14 months in advance of the general election. I just think that's way too long. This bill solves the problem by allowing each major party to adopt a rule establishing the pre-primary party membership duration requirement. Republicans and Democrats may well wish to keep the current 250-day requirement, but IPO would significantly reduce the requirement so that it precludes fewer potential candidates from being inadvertently disqualified. And I would say we would probably reduce the requirement to something on the order of 70 to 90 days. This problem is not entirely new to Oregon. It was addressed in California about 10 years ago. And the California legislature adopted a statute which is the Elections Code, Section 8001 there, which specifically exempts a candidacy filed by a candidate of a political party participating in its first direct primary election. It exempts people in the first direct primary election of a new party from the party membership duration requirements that otherwise apply in California. The second major barrier is that current statutes allow anyone, including party non-members, to win a major party primary by write-in with only a few votes. Because of the party duration restriction that I just mentioned, we would expect that many of the races on the IPO ballot will be blank, except an opportunity for write-in votes. The ballot will include all of those races, all of the legislative races. They'll be listed there for the voters to vote on, but there will be no candidates running. The law requiring advance party membership doesn't apply to write-in candidates. Anyone can win by write-in. And many of them would have probably little or no connection at all to the Independent Party of Oregon. This bill solves the problem by restricting write-in winners to those who are eligible to receive the nomination under the major party duration rules adopted by each major party and who earn a party-specified portion of votes sufficient to indicate a meaningful level of support from those voting in the party primary. Instead of allowing someone to win the write-in, some complete stranger to win the write-in with 5 or 10 votes, we would probably adopt a rule requiring something on the order of 1 to 5% of the folks who are eligible to vote in the primary. If our primary only includes IPO members, that would be somewhere between 1,200 and 6,000 votes in a statewide race. If we of course, the IPO has adopted a rule to allow NAVs to vote in the primary. If those folks are eligible, then the number would go considerably up. So this bill would remove the two major barriers to the IPO having a meaningful primary election in 2016, and I hope that you'll send it on to the floor. Thank you.
All right, I'm going to have the whole panel speak and then take questions or comments. Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Chair Hoyle. For the record, my name's Newt Buehler. I'm represented from House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend. And I have just a few comments. This is an interesting course of events due to the unusual qualification of the Independent Party of Oregon to be a major party, the third major party in the state, and statutorily equivalent to Republican and Democrat regards to these election issues. This issue was clearly defined and brought up as a concern when we had an independent party caucus meeting about 6 weeks ago, and remind you that's members who, like myself, hold both the Independent Party and either Democrat or Republican nomination in this last election cycle. And I think these unintended consequences not only occur in this issue, but others, which I'm sure you'll have to address in this legislative session. But I think importantly, it behooves all of us to find a way so that independent voters and non-affiliated voters have increased ballot access and participation in our election system, and particularly in the primary process, as this category, as this classification of voters, and increasingly the young voters, over 70% of young voters are registering in these areas, not in the major traditional major parties of Republican and Democrat. We have to find a way for these people to participate in our elections and make it much easier, especially in the primary election process. So I appreciate your consideration of these weighty issues, and I'll turn it back over to the experts in election law.
Frata.
From the Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sal Peralta. I'm here today to testify on behalf of the Independent Party of Oregon in favor of House Bill 3287. As Representative Buehler just mentioned, the emergence of the Independent Party as a third major party in the state creates some unusual situations with regard to the law. Typically, presumably, members of the committee, Democrats and Republicans here in the legislature, can have an opportunity to confer, discuss matters that relate to party membership requirements and so on, and reach some sort of an agreement on behalf of the political parties themselves. And that's really what's been happening over the course of the last 50 or 60 years. We've seen the legislature and the state take on roles that really are more properly reserved to the political parties themselves. The establishment of a membership requirement, any membership requirement, is really not a state concern. It's more of a concern for the political parties themselves. Who do the political parties choose to associate with? The Independent Party of Oregon, for five election cycles, has allowed candidates, regardless of their party affiliation, to seek our party's nomination. Never had a problem with that as a minor political party. Any minor political party can open their nominating processes up to anyone they choose. Once you hit the magic number to become a major political party, the rules change. And as I've mentioned to the committee before, the rules are going to change for us in 2016, and they're likely to change again in 2018 in terms of who can seek our nomination based on the passage of the motor voter law. We're expecting to be a major party for 2016, not be a major party for 2018. And this is one of the areas where the rules are going to change for us between those two election cycles. So this bill really is an attempt to try and bring ORS 249.046, which is the statute that determines who's eligible to run for a major party primary. This takes that and makes it more consistent, I think, with Article 4, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, which sets the requirements for who can serve in this body, as well as Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution and the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Our view is that the current statute's overbroad. There's no compelling state interest that is met by this statute that couldn't be accomplished by something that's more narrowly tailored. It's applied arbitrarily, as I mentioned earlier, in the sense that it only applies to major political parties and not minor political parties. Specifically, as applied to the Independent Party of Oregon, it appears to be contrary to associational rights that we've asserted in five consecutive elections. And it applies burdens to running for public office that are not contained within Article 4, Section 8. So we would hope that this legislature will see the wisdom in moving this legislation forward and allow these fixes to go through. And basically, the fixes that we're asking for are allowing political parties to establish their own rules for whether or not a candidate must be a member of a political party, that party, in order to seek the party's nomination and appear on the primary ballot. allow them to establish their own rules on whether or not they want non-members to win the party write-in, and allow political parties to establish their own rules to determine the minimum number of write-ins that are needed in order to win. All of these things are powers that are correctly associated with political parties, not correctly assigned to the state, and so we hope that you'll consider those constitutional questions and consider moving this legislation forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the committee? Representative Rayfield.
So as I was reading, I don't see any sideboards on either of these things. So essentially, a major party can determine the date by which they have to become to be eligible for the primary. So you could make that 15 days. Are there sideboards put in place? I mean, obviously, our job is to make sure that the system isn't manipulated. Going forward, some of the other sideboards on the, the major party would be able to determine what makes an eligible candidate for a write-in. That's pretty darn broad, and there's, again, no sideboards, it seems to me. So I was just kind of curious if that had come up, as you guys were drafting this, if you thought about that.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, my position is that our party should not necessarily have a membership requirement at all to run as a candidate of the party. The party was formed to provide ballot access for people who did not want to run as a Democrat or as a Republican. We are meeting with people around the state and encouraging those people to run, but I don't know that I would necessarily prefer to encourage them to change their party registration. And in fact, Representative Rayfield, Chair Hoyle, I believe at least five of the members on this committee have more than one party nomination, and there's nothing that prevented you. You're not a member, for example, of the Working Families Party, and yet you have the Working Families Party nomination. Other members of the committee have that same nomination. Some have our nomination. And so it really begs the question, why do we need the membership requirement in the first place, and what's the compelling state interest in having a membership requirement? I can certainly see the interest of a political party to have a membership requirement. The Democrats may very well say, well, only Democrats allowed, or Republicans might say the same thing, but our party prefers to have associations with that go beyond simply members of our own party.
And can I address that as well, Madam Chairman? Yes. Representative Rayfield, as far as a minimum number of days that a person is affiliated with the party, I think you're right. It could go down to 15. It could go down to zero under this bill. It also could go the other way, that is, a party could adopt a requirement that everyone running in the primary must have been a member of the party for 10 years. And so perhaps it would be a good idea to make the existing 250-day advance requirement the maximum, that you can't go out more than 250 days, but you can go less than 250 days, which, as I've explained, is particularly important in the case of a new party.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Chair Hoyle. So I was curious because I did not seek the independent party nomination when I ran, and so I wondered if Representative Buehler, you said you were endorsed by the independents and the Republicans. Can you just tell me how that process went? Because I didn't do it. So
that's a process where it's ballot. In fact, maybe these folks remember the process better than I do, but it's a process where ballots are downloadable, I believe, is how it was done this time. And this is some of the difficulty, is that it's a difficult process to download the ballot, fill it out, and then send it back in. And it's out of sequence with the normal primary, so people are not thinking that there's really election going on. I would like to see not only the independent party, but all the minor parties having their primary election in similar fashion, and not have these one-off exemptions, but have them all very similar, if not the same.
So. Okay. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
And what kind of participation do you guys get? Do you know? Like, do you have a district? Like, what was the participation in your district or statewide?
So, Representative Smith Warner, Chair Hoyle, the process is we send a voter's pamphlet to the households of our full membership, and then we encourage candidates to.
Can I ask a quick a version of the state one?
No,
or?
I'm sorry. Chair Hoyle, Representative Smith Warner. The party produces at its own expense a voter's pamphlet, which is then mailed out statewide to its entire membership. That directs them, in addition to providing information about the candidates on our ballot, it directs the voter to go to a website where they can enter in their personal information through a secure online form, and then it will produce their individualized ballot, which, depending on the election year, we have either required them to mail in with just a signature or mail in with a scan, some form of scanned ID that was roughly analogous to what someone would return with a voter registration card. It was very much a learning process for us.
The first time you did it?
The first time we did this was in 2010. At that time, we had a professional election vendor, Everyone Counts, that conducted the election. I believe the statewide participation was around 5%. And then we conducted the primaries using our own software in 2010, 2011, 2012, and 2014. We were actually very pleased with the participation rates across the board. We were sort of slammed publicly for what people regarded as low participation rates. We attribute that, as Representative Buehler said, primarily to holding an election at a weird time, but also to the use of the internet as a vehicle for distributing ballots. The research that we found, and our election was included in federal reporting on internet elections. It was the first binding statewide election conducted over the in the United States. So we didn't have a lot of good points of comparison. But the points of comparison that we had for participation rates were the Democratic Party in Arizona spent millions of dollars conducting an election in 2002 using both the internet and kiosks out around the state. And their participation rate, I think, was about 7%. Internet elections have a very, very low response rate. The gold standard for this is an Eastern European country, and I'm forgetting, but I can get you the data. Estonia, thank you. And their participation rates were between 4 and 5%. So our numbers were fairly consistent with what we've seen in other internet-based elections. And that's a lengthier answer than you're probably hoping for, but that was our experience.
May I also add, Madam Chairman and Representative Smith Warner, we would have loved to send out individualized ballots to each of the members in the last election. I think it was about 84,000. But we calculated that that would cost between $500,000 and $1 million, and we just don't have the funds to do that.
Thank you. Representative Rahill.
Yeah, I would certainly note that I think for a minor party to engage in a primary system is very costly. And so I appreciate those comments. I was also involved in the 2010 primary election. And so through that process, I actually spent a lot of time calling people. And I think our state Senate race have one of the highest petition rates across the state. But I also found that there were a lot of very well-educated people in the community, people, attorneys. I actually had one judge that weren't even aware they were a part of the Independent Party. When I was calling them and asking them for that. Did you guys find, I mean, you're obviously on the inside. My experience was there was a high percentage of folks that weren't aware that they were even a member of the party. What is your experience with that, and how does that relate to kind of your turnout?
I don't think it relates significantly to the turnout. I do think that there is an issue where some people join the party thinking that they were signing up NAV. Some people are NAV that want to participate in our elections that can't because they're not a member of a party. So I think the growth of our party really surprised us, to be perfectly blunt, and I think I've said that in testimony previously. But at the end of the day, we have a core of about 2,000 people around the state that are regularly engaging, which those of you who are involved in partisan politics understands that that's a fairly significant number of people actually being active and doing stuff. And so anytime you have a new organization with a name that people like, you might have a little bit of early confusion. But as we continue to build our brand, and we've now existed for nearly 10 years, we imagine that, that is going to change somewhat significantly. So, and again, the fact that we're conducting an election at an odd time, I think, also adds to confusion.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will ask if there's anyone else to testify on this bill shortly, but first I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3287. And as we have Representative Buckley here, I'm going to open a public hearing work session on House Bill 3521. Erin, will you explain the measure?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3521 designates third week in April of each year as Independent Media Week. We have no revenue and no fiscal impact on that measure.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the Oregon Legislature. Request came from constituents who are involved in local media in my district. There's a radio station, KSKQ, which is a community radio station that's been developed just through the love and hard work of the people who are passionate about radio and passionate about community news, and a very, very eclectic lineup on KSKQ. But they are passionate about independent media. They convinced the Ashland City Council to declare Ashland has a Independent Media Week, and they asked me whether I would see if my colleagues would be willing to declare a statewide recognition of independent media, everything from community radio stations, community newspapers, the people who blog, who can drive you crazy, of course, but sometimes the information that comes through an independent source leads to some progress in something that we're all concerned about. So. I'm grateful for the people who volunteer their time and their effort and have the passion for independent media, and I'm just asking for recognition if this committee is willing to join me in that request. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, I'm trying to get a handle on whether I can get really personally excited about this bill, and to do that, I have to ask if it applies to me or my company. We're not affiliated with anyone else. It's just us. We own two media properties, and that's it.
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, this bill is to celebrate you and your work as well.
Madam Chair, I am really excited about this.
I have to say, Representative Wilson, I haven't heard you say that about any of the other bills in this.
Thank you.
But, Madam Chair,
Representative Smith,
I'm concerned, however, that my good colleague, Representative Wilson, may have to recuse himself because of his conflict of interest.
Madam Chair, it's a large class. It's a large class.
Okay. Yes. Representative Kenmer?
Let's see. So are we going to make this retroactive this year?
I'm not sure. Is this the third week of April now? I've lost track.
No, today is the 15th, according to my watch.
We're in the ballpark.
Next week, I think.
Well, thank you, Representative Buckley. My father also works on a community radio station, has a program, Thinking Out Loud, is a progressive radio station in Lowell, Massachusetts. That has programs in Cambodian, in Spanish, and in English.
Wow.
So I think this is fantastic. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm probably simply confused about the language. Does independent media mean radio, or does it mean something broader than that?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, it means all media. It means print, radio, TV, internet, all media.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd like to make a comment if I could then. Our district, which is mostly rural, has a number of small cities in it, and several of them have weekly newspapers. Those communities tend to have much higher levels of community participation in community activities, much more community spirit, as it were, loyalty to the community and interest in working on things that are beneficial to not just the individuals but to the whole community. And so I hardly support this kind of recognition for those hardworking, small, and small circulation, independent, mostly weekly newspapers. And I think your bill does that, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Great. Any other comments? No. Okay. With that, we are in a work session. I would accept a motion.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make a motion right now. Half of my friend Representative Buckley, and that's why I move.
There, just would you like to move House Bill 3521 to the floor with the two-pass recommendation?
It's funny that you should mention it, because I would like to move House Bill 3521 to the floor with the two-pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved House Bill 3521 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion or objection? Seeing none, this motion passes. Representative Buckley, would you like to carry this on the floor?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I certainly enjoy.
We will close the public hearing work session on 3521, and then we are going to also open a public hearing on House Bill 3297. Aaron, will you explain the measure?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3297 requires a general or special election ballots list name of candidate for partisan office for each nomination candidate receives, with name of each political party that nominated a candidate printed opposite one of listing of candidate's name, allows candidate to decline to be listed as nominee of political party, specifies that votes cast for candidate of affiliation of electors or minor political party on ballot line marked for that affiliation or party count towards vote requirement for minor political party formation or maintenance of minor political party status, specifies that multiple votes for candidate on same ballot for same office count as vote for candidate with major political party designation. We have no revenue impact, and a fiscal impact has not been issued, Madam Chair.
Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, again, Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County. This is the full fusion voting bill. Back when Representative McLean was in high school, I was on the Rules Committee, and we wrestled with several different ideas. Instant runoff voting was one of the ideas. We came actually close to passing. Full fusion was another concept that came forward the Rules Committee when I served on the committee at that time. And the idea behind full fusion voting was similar to, I think, some of the discussion you had earlier today. How does a minor party make its voice heard in terms of the agenda that it's proposing? How do they show that a certain percentage of their voters actually are really serious about the issues on their agenda in a political climate where the two major parties dominate? The state of New York has full fusion voting, and how it works is pretty simple. Representative Rayfield would be on the ballot as the nominee of the Democratic Party, since he belongs to the Democratic Party. He'd also be on the same ballot. It would say Dan Rayfield, Working Families Party, Dan Rayfield, Independent Party. So he would be nominated by three parties. And if I was in his district, I would vote, I'm going to vote Dan Rayfield, Working Families Party. And that way, when the votes are tallied for Representative Rayfield, the total votes, obviously, are what will determine whether he's the victor in the race or not. But the breakdown of which party votes he received would inform the representative when he goes to serve in the legislature who sent him there and who it was that sent him there and what their issues are. So it is a way to get that the minor party's ideas out in an endorsement of a candidate. When we brought this forward previously, there was a hesitation from the Secretary of State's office saying they really didn't know that they had the technology to list the same candidate's name with different parties. I think that's a moot point now. Even at the time, I asked them if I was running, say, for House District 5 in South Jackson County, my name was Peter Buckley, and if my opponent's name was Peter Buckley, would they be able to print that ballot? And they said, yes, we would. And I said, well, I don't understand why you can't print the ballot then with my name twice. But basically, again, full fusion is just the platform for which a minor party might be able to participate in a general election process and have their views carried by a candidate and a candidate to understand who actually sent him into office or her into office. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any questions?
I have a question.
Yes, Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Representative. Would this give me the full fusion voting, give me the opportunity to oppose Representative Rayfield three times? But seriously, would you have to pick one party? You can vote once.
Madam Chair, you could only vote once. You could only vote once on the ballot, and that would, again, you'd be voting and saying the agenda that Representative Rayfield has agreed to, that's the X party's agenda, that's the agenda you're backing and backing his candidacy.
Follow up. So not to challenge the idea, just to clarify, it's possible that the instructions could lead you to check it three times, which would invalidate your, so we'd want to be very careful about the instructions.
Madam Chair, that's correct. And I think we could look at how the state of New York has set it up, the instructions they've used, but you are correct.
Thank you.
I know you'd be tempted to vote against.
Representative Nose.
My question is, comes from Representative Gillum's statement. So wouldn't you just, you wouldn't vote no, you'd just vote for his opponent. Right?
Three times.
Me or you?
You. I'm going to vote for him. He's in my party.
Maybe so. But either way, we'd be limited to, and it would be important for the instructions not to confuse you. You got to pick a party, even if there are three options. Otherwise, you would invalidate your vote, and we'd go backwards instead of forwards.
I think that's a fair logistical question. Board, okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative. First thing I want to do before we move on for other testimony for House Bill 3297, was there anybody else here that had wanted to testify on House Bill 3287 about the Independent Party? If not, I'll move forward with this. Anybody? Okay. So with that, I will call up Jeff Anderson, Sal Peralta, and Dan Meek. Mr. Anderson, where did they go?
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Anderson. I'm the Secretary Treasurer of United Food and Commercial Workers Local 555. We're a private sector, primarily union, with 20,000 members, primarily employed in the grocery industry throughout the state of Oregon and Southwest Washington, in addition to a number of healthcare workers. And as an aside, I'm the chair of the Oregon Working Families Party. I'm enthusiastic supporter of full fusion, and I think Representative Buckley really summarized a lot of the easy aspect of how the process would work. But full fusion is not new to Oregon. We had it in this state up until about 1907. I believe it was 1907 was the first election cycle, or eight or six, that we did not have it. And this would really give minor parties a lift up in terms of branding, and that's over the political spectrum. So in the case of New York, there's the Conservative Party, there's the Libertarian Party, there's the Independent Party, the Working Families Party. But with so many new voters coming in and so many people, in all due respect to my friend with the Independent Party, I've found a number of folks that default into the Independent Party not knowing they're defaulting into a political party. And we've had these discussions. It would really give a sense of voters in a general election the opportunity to see where they fall out in terms of a spectrum, because the two brands, if you would, the national brands, Democrat, Republican, have been in decline since the 1970s as a percentage of the voter rolls. And this would really empower small parties, I believe. As an additional aside, in 1900, my great-grandfather was elected a state representative from Verbort, a little Dutch community in Washington County, as a state representative. As a member of the Union Party, he fused with the Democrats in 1900 and served the 1901 session. That party was made up of an ad hoc. And why I am a labor union official, the Union Party wasn't a labor union. It was taken from the seal of the Oregon Seal, a post-Civil War period party. It was a populist party. It did have the Knights of Labor, but it also had Catholics, farmers, and Grange members of the day. And they were able to, I believe, in the 1890 period through 1905, create a populist period. So we've had and enjoyed minor party participation in the Oregon election experience. In full fusion, I helped lobby it in 1907. I nicknamed it Fusion Light. Coming from the retail trades, like Bud Light, there's Fusion Light. Or I also called it Confusion because it was confusing to me. So this would give a lot of clarity in just want to put it on the record, we're enthusiastic supporters of bringing full fusion back to Oregon that we once enjoyed.
Mr. Peralta.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, my name is Sal Peralta. I'm testifying today on behalf of the Independent Party of Oregon, a ballot-qualified major party with 110,000 members statewide. From 2007 to 2009, I spent a lot of time lobbying for the current Fusion Light law. Very appreciative that the legislature saw the wisdom in allowing that to go forward. But I think as we now have more non-affiliated voters coming into the system, it is beneficial to us to know what is the market share of each of the political parties as they elect candidates. And this full fusion proposal would accomplish that. Speaking selfishly, I guess, as someone who's active with the Independent Party of Oregon, I would love to see which ballot line people vote for our candidates on. I suspect that we would get a very high percentage of the vote if Representative Kenemer, who's received our nomination, were listed as a Republican and independent. I think a very high number of people would be voting for him on the independent line. And I think that it's important to kind of understand what the market share of ideas is. It's been very effective. It's created some really innovative and interesting policy in New York State. It lends itself to building really interesting coalitions in this building, and I encourage you to move the concept forward.
Mr. Meek.
Chair Hoyle and members, I'm Dan Meek, and on this bill, I'm testifying on behalf of the Progressive Party of Oregon, a minor party, so full fusion would affect that minor party directly. I've supported full fusion for at least a decade here in Oregon, and I agree with what the previous witnesses have said about the value of it. I would point out two other things. First, that in the scenario outlined by Vice Chair Gilliam, what happens if a person votes for Representative Rayfield three times on the same ballot? That doesn't disqualify the vote. In fact, this bill specifically deals with that. On page 5 of the bill says, if an elector votes for a candidate more than once on the same ballot for the same office by voting for the candidate opposite multiple different political party affiliations, the ballot shall be counted as if the elector voted for the candidate only once on a ballot line with a major party designation. So that scenario has already been accounted for. One other effect no one has mentioned is that
I'm so glad you are trying to clarify this. So for the slow learners, the Secretary of State's office or county election officials would have to sort through that, so to speak, and they obviously someone had voted for Dan Rayfield three times, but they choose, because you've marked it three times, they choose the party based on the top line, some other?
Vice Chair Gilliam, what this is intended to do is to make sure that minor parties get credit only for votes that are really intended to be on the minor party line. And if a single voter, let's say, fills in the circle for Republican and the circle for Constitution, it's not clear whether that voter is really saying that I'm voting for this candidate because it is the candidate of the Constitution Party. The reason that's important is because in Oregon, the smaller minor parties maintain their status as minor parties only by earning 1% of the vote in statewide races. So it's important to know whether a vote for Representative Rayfield, which party is actually being specified for that vote. The statute does not indicate what happens, which major party designation it's counted for. I think that wasn't taken into account, that in fact someone might be running as the candidate of more than one major party. Of course, that happens now. About 25 to 30% of all legislative races every year now has the same candidate is both the candidate of the Democratic Party and Republican Party. And so the bill would, I think, have to be amended to figure out who gets that vote. I don't know that it matters. I don't think it necessarily, maybe no major party gets the vote in that case. I mean, the vote is counted as for the candidate, but it doesn't necessarily need to be counted for one major party or another, because the purpose here is simply to determine how many votes should be credited to a minor party line on the ballot. And that really introduces the one other thing I was going to say, and that is one effect of this bill would be that minor parties would be less likely to run their own candidates. Currently, in order to earn the 1% statewide, the minor party has to run its own candidate, can't be a major party candidate, in most cases it can't be a candidate who is also nominated by any other minor party. There are exceptions. But under this bill, a minor party could maintain its ballot access by nominating a major party candidate as long as enough voters choose the minor party line when voting for that candidate.
Any questions? Representative Rayfield.
I just really wanted to say thank you, everyone, for their support today. Unexpected pleasure.
Or lack thereof. Okay. Any other questions or comments? No. Well, thank you. And is there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 3297? Okay. Ms. Roth, come on up.
Rebecca Ross, chair and committee. I'm speaking as a signature gatherer, and I've done a lot of talking with the public who I ask, are you registered to vote? And they answer yes. And then we talk about ideas, and we're not necessarily talking about parties at the time. But what I've discovered is many, many, many people are very confused about what ideas are attached with which parties. There's so much lying that goes on by the parties, and that a lot of times people are very confused. And also, there's a lot of people I talk to who don't even know there's an independent party, let alone that by the way that they signed up, they're a member of it. And they thought they were trying to be independent. They don't want to be associated with a party. And they're offended that anybody would try to get that designation and push them into it. So there needs to be some clarification, it seems to me, on the people who really do want to be independent of any party. And so thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, with that, anybody else on 3297? With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3297, and I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3475. And I would like to call up Justin Martin, Dr. Koza, and Cappy Eaton.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3475 enacts Oregon's participation in Interstate Compact for election of U.S. President by national popular vote.
So who would like to start?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of National Popular Vote. With me is Dr. John Koza, the author of the National Popular Vote Plan, so I won't go into too much detail. I will save that for him. But what I would like to do, since we've been here a couple times before, is actually update the committee on what is happening throughout the country and what's happening and here in Oregon and why this bill is so relevant to the great state of Oregon. So with that, the National Popular Vote bill has been passed in 11 jurisdictions, Hawaii, Washington, California, Illinois, the District of Columbia, Maryland, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Vermont, and Rhode Island, which is 61% of the 270 electoral votes needed to trigger the interstate compact that you will hear about from Dr. Koza in just a moment. We've also passed at least one chamber in 12 jurisdictions. That includes Oregon, where we've passed this bill in the House in 2009 and in 2013. National Popular Vote has been endorsed by 2,142 of your colleagues across the country. And some of those supporters include Senator Fred Thompson, a Republican from Tennessee, Congressman Tom Tancredo, a Republican from Colorado, Governor Howard Dean, a Democrat from Vermont, and the former House Speaker, Newt Gingrich. The bill recently passed with a bipartisan vote of 28-18 in the Republican-controlled Oklahoma Senate. In addition, the bill was recently enacted into law in New York State after a 57-4 vote in the Republican-controlled New York Senate, where the concept was endorsed both by the Conservative Party and the Working Families Party. So you can see we're gaining a lot of bipartisan momentum across the country. Why is this relevant to Oregon? Well, as you'll hear from Dr. Koza, the winner-take-all system that we have in place, we are completely ignored in presidential elections along with 40 other states. That's important for a couple reasons. One, we had absolutely zero visits in 2012. We had zero visits in 2008. In looking at the states that had the majority of visits, Florida had 40 visits, Ohio had 73 visits, and Virginia had 36 visits. It also matters after presidents are elected, because we look at how they govern, and we look at policy that comes out of that. Oftentimes, it's policy that deals with senior issues, Medicare Part D in Florida, or soccer moms in Ohio, No Child Left Behind. The reality is we don't talk about what's relevant to Oregonians. We don't talk about natural resources. We don't talk about high tech. We don't talk about timber payments to counties. We don't talk about Pacific Rim trade. We would like to see that change, and we believe National Popular Vote is what can get us there. We hope with passage of this bill that we can start to put Oregon on the map so we can get a few of those presidential visits to discuss those issues. And regardless of how anyone feels about this bill, in opposition or within favor, I think everybody in this room can agree, everybody in this state can agree, and everybody in this country can agree that every person's vote should be equal and should matter, especially in this important election. You guys are going to hear today testimony in opposition with a lot of theories and a lot of different takes on this. And what I always boil this down to is the simplistic fact of every vote from every person in every state should matter in every presidential election. And let's not complicate this issue. Finally, the candidate with the most votes should win. So with that, thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for this opportunity to be in front of you today. I would urge your support of House Bill 3475. And with that, I'll introduce Dr. Koza. Thank you.
Dr. Koza.
Thank you. That's John, K-O-Z-A. Thank you, Chair Hoyle and Vice Chair Gilliam and Smith Warner. The National Popular Vote Bill would guarantee the White House to the presidential candidate who gets the most popular votes in all 50 states. And it would replace the winner-take-all statutes that exist in Oregon and 47 other states, which, in Oregon's case, you award all 7 of your electoral votes to the candidate who gets the most popular votes inside the state of Oregon, which means that when 750,000 people vote for Mitt Romney and 970,000 vote for Barack Obama, 100% of Oregon's voice appears to go in favor of the Democrat. The consequences of the winner-take-all rule is that in 4 of our 57 presidential elections, the second-place candidate has ended up in the White House. That's a 1 in 14 chance. But since half of our presidential elections over the years have been landslides of 10% or more, it's actually 1 in 7 in the non-landslide elections. Now, we've had 7 consecutive non-landslide elections in a row now since 1988, and almost certainly are headed for an 8th one. And lo and behold, 1 of those 7 went to a second-place candidate. So I think if the current political environment more or less persists, we can expect more of these second-place elections. But the more serious problem is not what happens in 1 in 7 non-landslide elections, but what happens in every single presidential election. We can say with certainty right at this moment that the states that are more than 3% above or below the national level of support for a candidate will get no attention. So, for example, in 2012, the 12 states that got some attention were all within 3% of Romney's 48% level. So, in other words, states that were between 45 and 51% Republican got 100% of the general election campaign visits and virtually 100% of the $1 billion that was spent on the campaign. And with that, all the attention to issues that are that go with campaigning in a state. Actually, Obama only campaigned in 8 of those 12 states, and two-thirds of the money and two-thirds of the general election visits were in just 4 states, which is Florida, Ohio, Virginia, and Iowa. So the remedy is in the Constitution. The Constitution gives the state legislatures the exclusive power to determine how electoral votes are awarded. And you can use that power to increase the voice of Oregon to the advantage of the state and to members of all parties in this state. The bill is an interstate compact. It only takes effect when states possessing a majority of the electoral votes, which would be 270 of 538, when that group of states enacts the very same bill, then it takes effect. And when it's in effect, what it says is that all of the enacting states will give all of their electoral votes to the candidate who gets the most popular votes in all 50 states. So the Electoral College would be guaranteed to represent the opinion, the majority opinion of the voters in all 50 states, and the Electoral College would have enough electors to guarantee the election of the candidate who gets the most popular votes in all 50 states. Thank you very much.
Oh, I'm sorry. We have another person. Yeah.
Yes.
Good afternoon. Chair Hoyle, members of the committee. For the record, Cappy Eaton, the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League supports very strongly House Bill 3475. When the League was organized 95 years ago, after decades of working to get the vote, we embarked on a lot of studies about the office of the president and about the whole presidency, what the presidency is all about. We concluded that in this form of democracy, What we needed was direct election of the president. Everybody voted for the president. There wasn't any of the other thing. So, in essence, we supported the repeal, if you will, of the Electoral College. The Electoral College should be abolished, we feel, because it really is an impediment to direct election of the presidency. And as you've heard, we've already had four elections which ended with the person receiving less than the popular vote actually becoming president. We first began talking about the national popular vote in 2006 at our national convention when we started some discussion. And our members across the country, because we are a grassroots organization, our members across the country began holding forums and workshops and receiving information and having discussions about what is this national popular vote. Following the 2012 national convention, because of the grassroots interest and concern about the election of the president, the League of Women Voters of the United States added to our position on abolishing the Electoral College a sentence that said the national popular vote was an alternative because trying to get a constitutional amendment to abolish the Electoral College is really not in the cards for some time. It's not going to happen. So this is an alternative to reaching closer to our hope for a direct election of the president. We have a lot of suppression of voters legislation going on around the country. This will abolish that also. So we urge you very strongly to move 3475 with a due pass to the floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Are there questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've just reviewed the measure, and I realized that I'm sure that it was inadvertent, but one of the witnesses misspoke. The measure actually applies to the 50 states plus the District of Columbia, and I think that's important to note because they currently have electoral votes in the Electoral College. I'd like to make a couple of comments of my own, if I might. I'm especially grateful for the League of Women Voters' comment about the number of votes being cast. In places like Oregon, where we encourage people to register and vote rather than discourage it, that gives us an added advantage in a presidential election when the measure of who wins is the popular vote rather than the Electoral College. And of course, this accomplishes that. And I think I suspect that she's also right that this would have an effect to discourage states from trying to discourage voters from registering and voting in the various methods that's being done today. I wanted to note first also, the United States, I think, is the oldest large democracy in the world. At the time in which it came into existence, nobody knew how to do this. And the different states had very different rules for who got to vote. The result of that was that in order for, and of course the delegates were very jealous of their own state's prerogatives about how those states would operate and what kind of powers they would have. And so that's why we end up with a Senate with two members from each state and the House of Representatives apportioned more or less by population at that time. But in some states, the vote was limited to men with a certain amount of property. In other states, it was much more open than that. And of course, in no state could slaves vote. So that's how this kind of mechanism got developed in the first place. And at the beginning, it was probably absolutely essential. The Electoral College was probably absolutely essential to get the Constitution written and approved. It is simply an anachronism now. This is a very clever method, it seems to me, to effectively get rid of it. and to actually move us to a popular vote system by using the mechanism to get there. And I applaud the people who came up with the idea. I have to tell you, when I first heard this idea, I was extremely skeptical of it. It took you a year to talk me into it, but I finally figured it out, and I understand it now, and I'm very happy to support it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments from this panel, for this panel? Fantastic. With that, I will call up next, and I apologize if I get your names wrong. Just correct me when you speak for the record. Art Crino, Raymond Godfrey, and Janice Deisinger.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Art Crino from Tigard. I appreciate this opportunity. I remind you that the word democracy does not appear in the Declaration of Independence, in the Constitution, or the Constitution of the 50 states. Our founders were very knowledgeable in republics and democracies, and they avoided democracies with the plague. And we all know the story about immediately after the Constitutional Convention, where a lady approached Benjamin Franklin and said, "Dr. Franklin, what have you brought us?" He said, a republic if you can keep it." And of course, so there we have the Electoral College, which is described in Article 2 and modified in the 12th Amendment. Now, there's no latitude in there for the direct election of the president, as you know. Remind you that, you know, Adolf Hitler, Benito Mussolini, and Fidel Castro were elected by popular vote. In 1913, we passed the 17th Amendment for the direct election of the senators, U.S. senators, a huge step in the direction of a democracy. The founding fathers must have been spinning in their grave. I propose that we should work on repealing of the 17th Amendment so that you are the ones to be selecting the United States senators. I also recommend a no vote on 3475. Thank you.
Thank you very much. First.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Hoyle and members of the committee. I'm Janice Deisinger. I'm a citizen from Multnomah County. I agree with what Art just spoke about that we're a republic and not a democracy. Our founders wanted very much to include all of the different areas of our country, not just the bigger urban areas that would overshadow the small communities, as you spoke about earlier today in the media bill, that the small communities are a very important part of our nation. And this bill would allow the more urban areas to have an undue influence on the small communities, because their votes would, you know, like there's 38 million people in California, and I believe there's, I'm thinking 7 in Oregon. I probably am wrong on that, but quite a few different, and so a percentage of California could overshadow Oregon's votes. And we find that in the recent testimony I saw with one of the oversight committees, that John Husted and Chris Kobach both testified there that the numbers of people that are registering to vote that are not citizens is very concerning to them. And if you if a state were to have election fraud in that state, we would have no standing for the election fraud that's going on in that state, but it could highly affect the outcome of our electoral votes being cast for someone other than what we intended it for. And we have zero standing. And Mr. Husted, Secretary of State of, I think it's Ohio, and Mr. Kobach asked the Justice Department for information about non-citizens so they could verify their own voter votes, and it was denied. So this, we see 12 states enacting voter laws for their, driver's licenses for their non-citizens without legal presence, and we see Social Security numbers being given to non-citizens without legal presence. Those are documents where they can register to vote, and there was a study done by, I believe it was Yale or Harvard, I can get it to you, that showed that it was there were enough of them voting that were affecting the outcomes of elections. And that testimony was before Congress, and I found it quite concerning. So if those states that are allowing this documentation to take place and allowing people to register to vote, and we find them voting and affecting our electoral votes, we will be causing a great deal of concern in our country. I believe it will disrupt the peace of our country if an election were to take place in this manner. And I would appeal to you to protect our current system and to protect the vote of Oregon and not pass this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Godfrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'd like to appeal to you also to uphold the Constitution.
Oh, could you just identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry?
Could you just identify yourself for the record?
Raymond Godfrey, I'm sorry.
Okay.
There's a reason that it's difficult to change the Constitution. It was made difficult for a reason. And this attempt to circumvent our system is atrocious to me. And I consider the attempt to change the Constitution by this manner as sedition. But that's just my opinion, and that's a matter of inconsequential reality. But I'd like to appeal to you to support the Constitution. The representative system, electors that we send, they have to take their votes on a prescribed day, opened on that prescribed day, to eliminate the possibility of fraud. And you can see that the potential for fraud, if we could rely on computers, is enormous. The most sensitive time in any country's transition is when the administrations are changing. We don't need to have a situation where fraud is a possibility. The electoral votes that are delivered on the specific day that they're to be delivered are open right there. And I'd like to appeal to you to reject this and not send it to the floor. And I'd like to echo the gentleman's comment about the 17th Amendment. Currently, the state of Oregon has no representation in the U.S. Senate. We have senators, but they're not representing the state of Oregon. They're elected at large. Our original Constitution was set up that we the representatives represent the people. The U.S. senators represent the state government. Currently, the Oregon government has no representation in the Senate. I'd like to echo the gentleman's comment about repealing the 17th Amendment. Thank you.
All right. Any questions for comments, questions for this panel? Okay, Representative Nose.
Thank you all for your testimony. I'm truly curious about this. This is the first I've ever heard of this. So why is it that you would want to repeal the 17th Amendment?
The 17th Amendment changed the Constitution so that the Oregon legislature, or any state, the legislature no longer selects the U.S. senators.
I understand that.
the people do at large. That's not the way it was set up. It was set up that on a population basis, the U.S. representatives represent the people to Congress, whereby the U.S. senators were to be chosen by the state legislatures to represent the state legislature. So you as a legislative body have no representation in the U.S. Senate because of that. I doubt that you ever talked to our U.S. senator.
Could I, Madam Chair, Representative Noyes, could I comment just maybe one particular possibility? Say the House of Representatives, of course they have the purse strings there, and they can get carried away with spending money. However, your representatives, if the senator were elected by you, then they would be kind of a watchdog. And if they went along with wasting money, then they would come back to you and you would probably replace them. So I believe that's one of the mechanics that I would visualize as an advantage to having the senators beholden to you.
Madam Chair, may I follow up?
Sure.
I want to thank these folks for bringing this here. I have to say this is an interesting civics lesson. I mean that sincerely. I've never heard of this before, so I'm kind of fascinated by it. I can't help but say, though, that I think that removing the right of the people of my district to help vote for their United States senator would make me pretty unpopular. So it's a fascinating thing that you're bringing forward, repealing the 17th Amendment, but I don't think it would be very well received in my district for what it's worth. But it's very interesting.
Can I make a comment on that?
Sure.
Our wealth is determined by our utilization of our natural resources. You could have an influence by directing the Senate to make our resources more open to us and usable to us. Currently, we can't use 60% of our forests. If you had influence with the U.S. Senate through your senator that you as the state legislature elect, we might initiate some change so we could use our natural resources.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And with that, we're going to take a moment to suspend. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing. I will reopen it so other people can speak, but I just want to. So I will close the public hearing momentarily on House Bill 3475. And.
Chair Hoyle?
Yes.
I request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow Representative Mike McLean, to vote on the motion to move HCR 26 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow Representative McLean to vote on the motion to move HCR 26 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. If there are no objections, so ordered. Representative McLean, how do you vote?
Yes.
Representative McLean, would you like to co-carry the measure with Representative Smith?
I would. I wasn't here, but Dave Jones, I grew up with. He was the only medical care we had in my town. And I didn't know this bill or this memoriam had been introduced and was here today, and I was delayed. So it's with great honor that the guy who put back in my teeth after they were knocked out in a baseball play where another kid ran into me. He was a wonderful man, so I'm honored to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, gavel out. Now I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3475. And I would like to call up Savannah Klump and Kate Titus. Whoever would like to go first.
Sure.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Savannah Klump. I'm a second-year student at Western Oregon University, as well as the chairwoman of the College Republicans of Western Oregon. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to come and speak before you in favor of the National Popular Vote Bill. I believe Oregon voters should matter as much as the battleground state voters in every presidential election. This would be the net result of the national popular vote. I've heard the rhetoric of opponents who wrap themselves in the cloak of the Republic and or the Founding Fathers. Well, I have read the Constitution, and it says, and I quote, "Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors. It is the role of the legislature to determine how Oregon will award their electors." And I would argue that we would have more influence and a greater voice if each of Oregon's voters were courted by candidates seeking the American presidency. I've also heard critics throw around words like republic and federalism and contend that national popular vote runs counter to those two principles of government. Well, I'm a student, so I did a little research. A republic is a form of government that elects leaders to represent their interests for a set period of time or term. For example, each of you serves a 2-year term on behalf of the voters of your district. America will be a republic before, during, or after national popular vote. Federalism deals with the separation of powers among local, state, and federal government. A vote for national popular vote, which is an agreement among the states, respects and retains the exclusive state power of awarding electors. It is the essence of federalism. The voting question on national popular vote is fairly simple, and it is stark. Do you as a legislator believe every voter in Oregon should matter in every presidential election? Or do you believe we should continue to secede our political voice and values to battleground state voters in closely divided states like Ohio? I urge you to support the national popular vote bill today. We, the people of Oregon, will thank you for making every voter in every state matter in every presidential election. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Titus.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee. My name is Kate Titus, and I'm here representing Common Cause, which is a nonpartisan organization that works for open, honest, and accountable government. And I'm here to express Common Cause's strong support for this national popular vote bill. I'll just summarize briefly our reasons for supporting this bill. Electing a president is really a core part of our self-governing process. It is one of the main ways that we publicly debate our priorities and direction as a nation. And yet right now, because of the way it's structured, that debate is really narrowly focused in a few swing states, and our votes are not really weighted equally. So we have a flawed system. National popular vote would solve that problem by putting every vote in play and equalizing the vote and making every state matter and ensuring that the candidate who wins the popular majority actually does win the election. I'd like to just highlight four benefits of national popular vote that Common Cause thinks are particularly important. First and most obvious, it respects every vote. It forces candidates to appeal for every vote rather than focus on certain electoral votes in a few swing states. Second, it puts Oregon back on the map, as others have mentioned. It incentivizes a full 50-state presidential race where political campaigns invest time and money engaging with all of the voters, and the policy discussions are more broadly representative of all of the ideas throughout the country, not the marginal concerns of a few small groups in certain swing states. Third, it increases voter confidence in the process. At Common Cause, we've found that Americans have an ingrained sense of democratic fair play. We want to think that the person who wins the majority is actually going to win the election. And I think that's why polls have shown repeatedly very strong popular support for national popular vote. And finally, fourth, national popular vote would increase voter participation. Now, we here in Oregon enjoy relatively high participation rates because we have vote by mail system that places a ballot in everyone's mailbox. But we still have a portion of our population that doesn't vote for various reasons. As a rule, battleground states have higher voter participation than the safe states, and that's because voters are more motivated to vote when we feel that our vote matters. So by passing national popular vote, we could increase our voter participation even further here in Oregon and around the country. I'll just close by saying that national popular vote is neither a conservative or a liberal bill. It's something I think we should all be able to get behind, and I urge the committee to pass this with a due pass vote. Thank you.
Questions for this panel or comments? I would like to say, Ms. Klump, thank you so much for your testimony. Very eloquent. And having grown up in the other state without a sales tax, which is one of the has one of the first primaries, New Hampshire, the attention given to the issues from New Hampshire and given to that state during a presidential election are considerably different than what Oregon is able to get. So when in Congress they look at voting on issues, the Pacific Northwest is notably absent, and we don't have any of those first primaries. And so I think your point is well made, and it's evident. So thank you so much for being here. All right, and with that, I will call up Rebecca Roth and Tim Cowan. And that's all I have signed up. Is there anyone else who is here to speak on this particular bill that didn't sign up or is interested in speaking on this bill? Okay, with that.
Okay, Rebecca, Chair and Committee, my name is Rebecca Roth, and I am a member of the Oregon Citizens Lobby, which has taken a position against this bill. I would like to remind you that if we subject ourselves to a pool and there happen to be fraud in other states, that we will not have any power over clearing the election in those other states. There were precincts back east where Obama won with 110% of the vote. If he won with 110% of the vote, there were people voting in that state that voted several times, or there were ballots submitted that were not part of the legal voting mechanism of that state, and it should have been challenged. And if we're just part of a pool, we're not going to have any voice in the fact that that's happening, and yet we're part of that pool. States which have voting machines, this last voting election, there were states where they were set to default to the Democrat position. And there were many Republicans who were very frustrated using those machines because they would get all done voting, and then it would, as they clicked, it would default. And there were states that have same-day voting. You sign up to vote the same day that you vote. There were people who signed up who also then at the same day went to the adjacent state. They were bused there by people who were organizing it, and they were bused to the next state and signed up and voted in that state too. We would have no say in that, and yet each of those votes count. They're illegal, fraudulent votes, and if every vote counts, do even the fraudulent ones count? I personally am so thankful that our founders created a system where I get to vote, my vote counts in Oregon, and I either win or lose in Oregon. And then Oregon, as a sovereign state, appoints people to represent me to the in the national in the federal system, which is, I believe, gives Oregon more of a voice than to be lost in a sea of voter fraud. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sir.
Madam Chair, committee members, one courtesy I would like, Madam Chair, is if Justin behind me starts looking mad, would you let me know and I'll excuse myself? First of all, one of the things that I disagree with is we have a process where you can change the Constitution.
Sir, did you
Tim Cowan.
Okay.
We have a method by which we can change the Constitution. And if you allow this to go through this process, what's the next issue going to be? It's just another one. So I think we need to be consistent with how we make those changes is all. First of all, there's been a lot of statements that I would agree with, and that is it does support a it enhances the status of minority interests, the Electoral College does. And it, as an example, if you take a look at New York and Oregon, New York has 19 million people, 29 electors. Oregon has about 3 million people, and it has 7. That means we have a 17% advantage. So in a sense, when we go to a popular vote, we lose a little bit of our status, if you will. And what this does, I think the Electoral College does provide a little stability in supporting a two-party system. If you go to a popular vote, how many candidates will be in consideration? What will be the percentage of votes necessary to be considered? What happens if you don't get enough for 50%? What if you have 330s? What are you going to use as criteria? The other thing that's kind of interesting about a popular vote, it would allow the states with the largest population to control everything. And I'll bet you one of the groups that support the popular vote come from the largest populated areas. As an example, states with the top or the largest 10 to 12 cities can elect a president. So what would happen is a candidate would focus on the states with the most population in the largest cities. It'd be just the opposite of what's been addressed. It would disenfranchise the smaller states like ours. Because we don't have the same magnitude that we do now, that means our opinions and our values and local interests would be discounted, such as things like agriculture. If we had issues that we wanted, and I think the timber industry was brought up, if we go popular vote, we're just a minor entity. We don't count as much. And the comment was made on swing states. One of the things that happens is a swing state can be a state that has a minority interest, has an opinion and values that can't be discounted because of the Electoral College. And one other thing which I think is interesting in the notes that I wrote down is if you go to a popular vote and get rid of our 17% advantage, in a sense, Oregonians don't vote. We're too small. Why would someone in a popular vote come to a state that is so small as ours when you can get elected by hitting 10 big cities and 10 big states? And I guess the last thing I would put, since the hour's getting so late, is there is a way to do this, period. And you have a method as opposed to a bunch of states going off and doing this, You don't know who's going to be screened, who can be a member, who can't be, whether that's going to change or modify. I had a hard time when I read the bill. I just started circling things and trying to understand how it worked. And if I start putting different scenarios together, I didn't know how to apply the bill to it. There is a method to take care of this issue. I am in favor of the popular vote. I think there's a lot of value to it. However, by going through the normal process of amendment, you put structure to it. And by putting structure to it, then I know whether I'm in favor of it. Right now, this has no structure to it. The states are going to get together, they're going to have these dates, and they're going to do this, and so on and so forth. I'll stop there, because it's getting late.
Any questions for this panel or comments?
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wondered if I was curious about your point about the population discrepancy and whether I get your angle on that. I wondered if the advocates would have another opinion on that.
Dr. Koza, what
he had said about, sorry.
But Dr. Koza, would you mind coming up and addressing this issue of population? So we're just going to call him up.
Sure.
To address that. So we just either have one of you, Ms. Roth, if you want to, if you just want to switch places with Ms. Roth. Dr. Koza, come on over here. For the record?
John Koza.
Great. So I think there was something brought up about the discrepancy as a smaller state. Does this disproportionately impact us to the detriment? Because of the larger cities and larger populations. And also, I think there's a point made about us with the Electoral College having 17% more representation than we would under a popular vote.
Well, political influence in presidential elections doesn't come from dividing your state's population by your number of electoral votes. And it comes from the political reality, which is that the presidential candidates do not campaign in states based on their number of electoral votes. They campaign there based on closeness. So take the 13 smallest states, which New Hampshire would be one, the states with 3 and 4 electoral votes. Of those 13 smallest states, only New Hampshire gets any campaign visits in the last 5 or 6 presidential elections. None of the others, Alaska, Hawaii, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, North and South Dakota, Vermont, Rhode Island, Maine, Delaware, D.C., none of them get any campaign money or attention to their issues. So political power doesn't come from the number of electoral votes. It comes from the fact that of the 13 smallest states, New Hampshire is the one that's almost 50-50. All the others are 60-40 or 70-30, and they have no influence. Now, Oregon is the 25th largest state, or smallest. You're right in the middle. Of the 25 smallest states, only 3 of the 25 get any attention over the last 30 years in presidential elections. There simply is no campaigning in the West except in the battleground state of Colorado and Nevada. So you, in fact, have no influence. California has no influence. Washington has no influence. The influence goes to those peculiar states, the 10 or 12 or 8 states, depending how you count it, that are super close. Now, there was some talk about the cities. First of all, the 100 biggest cities in this country have 17% of the population of the United States. I don't know what 10 big cities you could campaign in that would get you elected to anything. Curiously, the places that are small, the rural part of the country, that is all the counties that are outside the metropolitan statistical areas. There's 5 metropolitan statistical areas in Oregon. Biggest one, obviously, is Portland. Salem is one. Eugene is one, et cetera. All of the rural areas outside the standard metropolitan statistical areas amount to 17% of the population. Same number. The 100 big cities equal the rural area. The 100 biggest cities, they vote 63% Democratic. Not 98, not 99, not 110. They vote 63% Democratic. And the 17% that's rural in the United States votes 60% Republican, virtually a tie. And what's left? The 2/3 of the country that's suburban, not the 100 biggest cities, not the rural places, but all the places around Portland, Kaiser, all the places around Salem, et cetera, et cetera. So all of this talk about big cities are somehow going to control. There's nothing in the National Popular Vote Bill that makes a vote in a big city any more important than a vote in the smallest town in Oregon. And by the way, there's nothing in the current system that protects the smallest town in Oregon. There's nothing in the current system that protects agriculture. Look at the chart that's in your data, the back of our one-pager, and there's paper copies there, and you have electronic copies. There isn't a single agricultural state that's a battleground state. So all of this discussion that somehow the Electoral College protects small states, protects agriculture, gives Oregon some extra influence because you're right in the middle. That's not true. In fact, right now, if you look at the states that are equal in Oregon's size, which is Oklahoma and Connecticut, they all have 7 electoral votes, you'll find that right now you cast more votes than Connecticut and way more votes than Oklahoma. I think you need to look at the numbers. I would really ask you to look at the chart. All it is a chart of the 2012 presidential election. But when you look at the numbers, you'll see all these myths about big cities controlling and big states controlling. They just don't add up.
Okay. Questions, comments? Representative Wilson, then Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have to admit that there is a lot of voter fraud out there. I don't think that you can have a system this big without meaningful fraud in it. I'm not a conspiracy theorist or anything, just not a lot of faith in human nature. It seems to me one of the best and most compelling arguments made today about keeping things the way they are is the issue of voter fraud. In this particular situation, you either win or lose in our present system. I may not be thinking straight on that myself. So I wanted to ask you your comment about that.
Representative Hoyle and Representative Wilson, fraud is most effective when a small number of people can have a huge influence. And right now, when there's fraud in the battleground states, for example, fraud in Florida, or fraud in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, or fraud in Cleveland, in Ohio, it tilts the whole country. So it was said that you'd be dragged along by the fraud. Well, I'm afraid if there is fraud anywhere in the United States, you are dragged along already, because when there's fraud in the battleground states, a very small number of people in just one or two places have the potential. For example, in 2000, the state was decided by 537 popular votes. Now, if there was a fraud in Florida in 2000, I don't know if there was or there wasn't, anybody who could shift 600 votes in Florida determined who was in the White House, determined who was president of the United States governing Oregon. So this notion that somehow the current system insulates from fraud, in fact, it doesn't. You are just as subject to fraud under the current system as under national popular vote. And by the way, there are people of Republican persuasion and Democratic persuasion in every battleground state looking out for Republican and Democratic and other political interests. So I would say fraud is worse under the current system because we know for a fact how close these states are. To pull off a fraud in a national election with 130 million votes, of which the closest national election in the last 100 years was 120,000 votes, it's a lot harder to flip 120,000 votes net than to flip 600 votes net.
And Representative Wilson, I will respectfully disagree that I don't feel that we have to admit there is a lot of fraud. I don't believe that, and I think that's just a difference of opinion. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. The argument that you just made in the last 5 minutes or so was the argument that was persuasive to me when I moved from skeptic to supporter. but I think I want to finish it because I don't think you do. I think the reality is that we have to think of, like a candidate for a minute. If I'm running for president and I have to win Pennsylvania and I have to win Ohio and I have to win Florida, then I'm going to go down there and I'm going to scrap for every single vote in those states under the current system. That's the reality. And of course, you've said that, but not quite that vividly. If we have a national popular vote, I'll go to a place where I think I can move 100,000 votes or 50,000 votes, and it doesn't matter what state it's in. If I think I can move them, then I'll go there. And it doesn't even matter if I win the state. I can lose the state, but if I move 50,000 votes, that gives me 50,000 more votes across the whole country and improves the odds that I'll win under the national popular vote system. I mean, I think it's that simple. A minute ago, we talked we're talking about voter fraud now. I consider the enormous limitations that are being placed on citizens in other states to register to vote or to actually cast a ballot as a kind of voter fraud. We don't call it that usually, but that's what it amounts to. We're telling people you can't vote, even though you ought to be able to. States that do that will have less influence under a national popular vote system because there'll simply be fewer votes cast in that state. And of course, you made that point when you, I don't know if it applies to this particular argument I'm making, but more people vote in Oregon than in Oklahoma. I think that was what you said. I assume that that's true. And therefore, Oregon under a national popular system will have more influence. If Oklahoma wants more influence, they'll go out and beat the drum and get more people registered to vote, which I think is a good thing, even if they're Republicans who vote Republican, while I'm a Democrat who votes for Democrats. So I think if you look at this issue vividly, in connection with the way people actually behave, that 500 vote difference in Florida becomes completely unimportant in a national popular vote setting, and absolutely critical in the one we have now.
Yes, Representative McClain.
Are we voting on this bill today?
We are not.
Okay, are we taking any more votes today?
We are not.
Okay. I've got folks delayed.
Okay.
I would like to comment, and probably, you know, I missed part of the presentation, but our federal government is only here because of the choice of our states, which are sovereign. Our states predated the federal government. Correct? Do we both agree on that?
This state didn't.
This state didn't, but yes.
I don't think the intellectual argument changes because we became a state in 1859. We are, all states are sovereign and have given the government limited powers, the federal government. What you're talking about here in this bill, colleagues, is taking the executive branch of the federal government and handing that over to a non-state system of selection. I mean, ultimately, a popular vote where states cede what is, I think, ultimately their constitutional duties. And it seems to me that we have a Senate and we have a House and a legislative branch. We have a judiciary branch appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate. And when you look at that construct, I'm troubled by a compact that would further relegate what is the importance of the fact that we are a nation made up of 50 independent states that have come together and have a federal government. It's not that we are a federal government that has a sub-tier, a JV team called the states. And I'm troubled by the symbolism of the national popular vote. I'm troubled by the fact that it has an effect of amending our Constitution without the proper procedure. I'm troubled by the fact that it's a continued affirmation of a rejection of the origin of our Constitution, which is, in essence, a centralized government having only the power that the states have chosen to give it. And all other power has been reserved to the states. And it does not bother me at all that a president has to campaign in the states in which she chooses to go to based upon the electoral vote count of those 50 states. Because ultimately, the 50 states choose the president. That's the Electoral College. And I have not heard anything which tells me that we should choose our president in any other way. And I think as a candidate plans to run for president, she has to look at those 50 states and basically say, how do I win the majority of votes? Because they're already weighted. We only have seven. California has a bunch. And I just have not seen the compelling argument. I mean, let's face it. How many people actually meet the president? How many people are going to be meeting the president in a race? Most of that is done by media. And whether you're sitting in Toledo or Timbuktu, you're watching a commercial. So I'm not persuaded at all by the fact that some states have presidential candidates visited less. I'm just very bothered, again, just very bothered by the fact that there seems to be this wanting to ignore the fact that the federal government works for us. And the chief executive of that federal government, the executive branch, has been chosen by an electoral college that the states send to select that branch's CEO. And I just don't see how a modern popular vote furthers our interests. In fact, I think it takes us away from the origin of where we are. But, you know, again, I voted no on it every single time it's been here. I'll vote no again today. I'll vote no when it comes to the floor, if that's what you choose to do, Madam Chair. But I wanted to say my piece. I'm beyond just rejecting the argument. I think it continues to be an affront to the notion that the federal government extends from us in the 49 sister states, and we should retain control of our electoral votes.
Thank you very much. With that and no further business, I am closing the public hearing on House Bill 3475, and this meeting is 3475, and this meeting is 3475.